This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Good afternoon, Mel Driscoll.
Good afternoon. Politician, priest, parent, radio talkback host. Our guest is at ease in all these roles, yet uneasy about pent-up pressure to offer platforms online that crowd out the tried and trusted balance of professional journalists reporting on current issues. TVNZ forecast its losses at between $28 to $33 million in the current financial year. Already it cut long-standing current affairs programs, Sunday and Fair Go, to lessen its losses. John Terrace heads an organisation with high hopes for news coverage, Media Matters in New Zealand. John Terrace.
Good afternoon, sir.
Hey, good afternoon to you, Mel. Lovely to talk to you and the community radio guys at Free FM.
Yes, no. I've got a point to where we'll get through. Is news being dumbed down at the moment?
Well, I think it's always been dumbed down a bit, guys, in the sense that television has a way of spoiling news by having it interrupted constantly by commercials. So it has to kind of stand out from the commercial material by over-sensationalizing, that's a word that I never thought of before, but over-sensationalizing the headlines. So you get over-dramatization of current events. And I think that if you watch the television news, you'll see what I mean. Mm-hmm. They go out of their way right from the drum roll at the beginning, which sort of suggests that Armageddon is about to arrive. And then up until he recently dropped it, the main newsreader on TVNZ, Simon Dello, almost invariably pitches his voice as if he was going to announce the end of the world as we know it immediately or very soon. So they sensationalise and at the same time trivialise the real news. The best place for you to source news, folks, if you really want to have your news brought to you in that way, is Radio New Zealand News.
Yep.
Because it's factual, it's straight, and it doesn't fight with commercial messages for your attention.
I can tell you now that I haven't watched TVNZ News or TV3 News for about 6 months. I'm more inclined to watch stuff on YouTube where I'm trying to follow the American elections and the debates. I'm more interested in that than watching TVNZ or TV3 News.
Yes, and I think that's going to continue to be the case. And TVNZ in its present form has already signaled that it's going to be re-equipping, it's going to be switching increasingly to digital platforms, and it's more increasingly leaving its current free-to-air space. But they're not being honest with us about it. They're not. I mean, except in the most general terms, they're not talking about the need to upgrade in order to take advantage of new technologies, and they should be. They should be, because we own it. TVNZ is a publicly owned platform that doesn't care about its audience, who happen to be its owners, the public of New Zealand.
The TVNZ chief executive, Jodie O'Donnell, she did advance the idea that a 24-hour news service, or more frequently updated short news bulletins, could be part of the answer.
What I'm confused about here is exactly who she thinks she's talking to and who she thinks she's accountable to. I mean, it's not her shareholders and it's not her advertisers that she's accountable to. She's accountable to us, the public of New Zealand. And in that role, she's obliged legislatively to take us into her confidence.
Mm-hmm.
It's no good saying about, you know, how what she might do or what might happen. She needs to tell us what her plans are, and then consult widely with the public.
Has a change of broadcasting minister from Melissa Lee to Paul Goldsmith helped?
Look, I couldn't say. I don't know. I'm hoping, possibly against hope, that he may come through. What he needs to do is to bring about the passage of the Fair Digital... Fair Bargaining Bill, which is still sitting there somewhere in the out tray, but capable of being revised, that will allow not only TVNZ, but the other current television news outlets some break from being completely eaten alive.
Yep.
By overseas social media.
Is this the bill that's will also protect Shortland Street from being axed?
Well, I don't know whether it'll do that or not, but I would hope that it would. It'll certainly create a new income flow for TVNZ and the other television channels. Instead of having them, as I said, being eaten alive by Facebook and Twitter X and, you know, et al., TikTok and all the other rubbish, which is actually being banned around the world.
Yep.
And it will shortly be the case in New Zealand, I'm sure.
Yep.
If there's one thing I know about Paul Goldsmith, it is that he does listen to what the public is saying. He has picked up on something that Melissa Lee obviously couldn't or didn't, which was that they had a responsibility as a government, the present government, to create a path forward legislatively for them to be able to survive. And that means stumping up and taking on internet media who are, as I say, eating their lunch.
As part of the shift to the digital platforms entices listeners, viewers, to change their viewing habits. Jodie O'Donnell said that New Zealand may be following the Australian example of introducing regulations that would require television manufacturers to pre-install local broadcasters' apps and ensure that they are prominent on their TV menus. Will that help a transition?
Well, it would, but I guess I've got to re-emphasise here, Mel, and it's in a way good and bad. It's good that she's actually taking us into her confidence, but it's bad that she doesn't realise that it's to us that she is accountable, and that instead of talking about possible options, she should be presenting us with a series of options for us, the owner of TVNZ, to decide what we want. In the end, it's going to be what the public wants that will decide the future of TVNZ.
You talk about digital platforms, and I have to say this, Sean Plunkett and the platform, he went on a rant about the Wellington Mayor... Your Wellington Mayor having problems with her health, and it comes down to having problems with it. And I put in a complaint to the BSA as I followed the rules. I get an email back from Plunkett saying, oh, we don't submit to the BSA. Is that true? Do all these platforms have to submit to the BSA?
Well, I mean, I think that's a matter for the legislators, for the government to decide. These are all new platforms. Of course, they should be subject to the law of the land. Of course, Plunkett should, like everybody else, be accountable to the public of New Zealand through its parliament. I mean, he shouldn't be allowed to access the internet without any accountability at all. But he's following the lead of these of the Twitters, the TikToks, and the other predators, international predators, who are simply using the internet as a means of making money. In Sean Plunkett's case, I mean, at least he's a local commentator, so I suppose we should encourage him.
And of course, Michael Laws follows them too. So,
well, we would hope they would, but at the moment, it's a free for all out there.
Yep.
There isn't any law as to where. I mean, Plunkett's simply drawing attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
He isn't accountable to anybody because the law says he isn't.
Ian.
Well, the law doesn't include us. include him, rather.
Yeah.
But the platform should be part of a more comprehensive accountability arrangement for all social media to either pay up or shut up.
Yeah, of course, the other platform, the online platform featuring Peter Williams and Rodney Hyde, that went down the Googler, I believe.
I haven't heard of it since it was announced. So I'm assuming that they haven't got any advertisers. They've just gone quiet because they're broke.
Yep. Have you completely recovered from your COVID outbreak?
I'm very pleased to say that I'm right back in the pink.
Hey, John, we've got to keep up with you in the media in the next few weeks. I'm going to read Shane Curry's Herald article tonight when I get home.
Good on you.
It's a pleasure.
He's a good source.
Thank you. Thank you, John Terrace.
Love you to talk to you.
It's a pleasure. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye-bye.
There's a man who talks sense mel about the media, John Terrace.
He would have been watching more media than normally the case during the time he is recovering from COVID.
Are we speaking to Gary this afternoon? We are.
Later.
And, of course, it was a Trump-Biden debate. Who won? Who lost? Is Biden past it? We'll find out from Gary shortly. Another Tony Hatch. Not a composition, but he conducted the orchestra. A World at War that was narrated, of course, by the late Sir Laurence Olivier. The Tony Hatch Orchestra, the theme to A World at War.
Coast watchers were the men watching, often from concealment, the enemy ships plying strategic waterways near Pacific nations. The Allies' intelligence relied on coast watchers to radio regularly the presence, the passing, the course of enemy shipping. Japanese radio operators on those ships would deduce from the radio signal's strength they were under the Allies' surveillance. No doubt the Japanese took every opportunity to locate radio operators, sometimes succeeding with very cruel outcomes. Murray Deer has studied history of the Coast Watchers' contribution to defending the Pacific Theatre. Murray.
Good afternoon, Murray. How are we? Hello, Murray. Well, we've gone quiet at the moment. Murray, are you there, please? Oh, are you there, Murray?
I can hear you.
Sorry, I must have pressed the wrong button. We were just talking about the cruel end to some of our coast watchers beheading. That's probably in your information too.
Yes, there was a pretty tough life for some of the coast watchers up in the Pacific, particularly those that were operating in what were then the Gilbert Islands, which were now Kiribati, because that was
those islands, Tarawa and Marken, and a few of those other islands in the Carabas group, they were overrun by the Japanese, and coast watchers were captured, and they did not have a very happy fate.
A terrible outcome for them. Mm. Were they recognised in the same ways as were those in the front lines?
Probably not. Initially, they were all designated just as civilians. Most of the radio operators were New Zealand Post Office radio operators who were experts in Morse code transmission, and these were the other coast watchers up in the islands were tended to be sort of more local traders, missionaries, things like people like that. They were all civilians, and it wasn't till after the coast watchers on New Zealand coast watchers on Tarawa, who were captured and then later executed by the Japanese, that the New Zealand government decided that all New Zealand coast watchers operating outside of New Zealand would be designated as military personnel, and they were all basically made given the rank of private. But that didn't happen until about mid 1943. Up until then, they were all civilians.
So those people, those New Zealanders, were they treated like spies by the Japanese, thus their execution?
Yeah, very much so. Because they were civilians working for the enemy, they were treated as intelligence agents. They had a on Tarawa, they had a very adverse result, not widely known, but the Americans actually offered to the New Zealand government to pull the coast watchers out when it became evident the Japanese could be moving south. But the New Zealand government, in its wisdom, and whoever the official was who authorised it, said, no, they volunteered to put their lives on the line, they can stay there. And that was probably one of the most terrible decisions made by a New Zealand official during the war.
Someone that has escaped public censure, but you've read about it?
No, there would have been some faceless bureaucrat somewhere. That's just the way it goes and sometimes. But, in addition to the... the front line was up in the Pacific. There were also coast watchers down in the sub-Antarctic. Initially, they went there in 1941 because it was expected that German raiders would use their big harbours down in the Campbell and Auckland Islands. So they were sent down south. There were coast watchers on Chatham Islands, where actually German raiders operated off there. And there were also New Zealand coast watchers all around New Zealand, particularly after Japan entered the war. There were a lot of sightings of so-called sightings of submarines, which mostly were absolute rubbish. Quite a few in the Cook Strait area. In fact, in the Cook Strait area, the very, very best coast watchers there were the Piranha Whalers. Mm-hmm. And they had a lookout over there, over the Tory Channel, because those guys knew what whales looked like.
Mm-hmm. This also caused the building of gun emplacements in the east of Auckland, and of course tunnels were built in North Head near the naval base, and it was to hide all the planes. But that's part of the myth of World War II also.
During World War II, the biggest gun emplacements were built on Waiheke Island at Stony Batter, which I've visited. They never fired a shot in anger. By the time they were built, the Japanese were in retreat. But there were quite a lot of, pretty much all around New Zealand, there were pillboxes and bunkers and instructions how to go, home guard, how to put logs in front of roads so to stop tanks and all sorts of things. But fortunately, the Japanese never came. There were Japanese submarines operating off New Zealand, at least four Japanese submarines operated off New Zealand and a German submarine. But um, they was uh, they they did little damage to to New Zealand during the war years.
I did find out, and I did research on this, but they did dig up Albert Park in the centre of Auckland.
Yes, I believe a lot of parks all around the countryside were dug up, and gun emplacements were put there, searchlight emplacements, all sorts of things. And of course, the silly thing is, when the Japanese did fly over New Zealand, there's three recorded flights of Japanese aircraft operating from submarines flying over New Zealand. There was no effort was made to intercept them. They didn't even know they were there. So it was pretty. Our defences during the Second World War were pretty hit and miss.
And I also found out that my late grandfather, Alf Scott, was a member of the Home Guard, Dad's Army, in round the Waikato, Cambridge.
All right. Yep.
Is the history all written now, Murray? The Coast Watchers, for instance. Is there anything still to be learnt, given that they are very old if they have survived?
Well, actually, I think pretty much all of the Coast Watchers have passed away. One of the last Coast Watchers still alive was a chap by the name of John Jones, and he lived in Te Aumutu, and he actually died just a few years ago. I knew his son actually very well. I interviewed John a few years ago before he died. He was down in the sub-Antarctic and as a radio operator down there. And and way down there, the Japanese never came down that far, but the Germans merchant raiders certainly operated down in the sub-Antarctic. And the German records show that they were passed close to our sub-Antarctic islands.
A relatively little known episode of our history involving the Coast Watchers, Murray, but it's thanks to people like yourself who keep it alive.
Pleasure talking to you, Murray, and is there a chance of another book? There must be so much information in that another book.
I get easily distracted and start off on one project and then dive off on another, and nothing seems to get completed. There must be something to do with my advancing years.
We wish you well. There are many years still to come.
Thanks very much.
It's a pleasure, yes, keeping alive our war history. And, of course, a lot of that history came out in that Thames television series, A World at War. Yeah. Premiered in 1959, the President of the United States was Dwight D. Eisenhower. When the series ended, Lyndon Johnson announced he wasn't running for president anymore. Gary Schofield, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, and it's nice to be here.
CNN estimates 51 million viewers tuned in to witness the United States' first presidential debate at Atlanta in Georgia, between Democrat Joe Biden and Republican Donald Trump. Afterwards, the survey of 500 registered voters by Shue and Cooperman Research found 51% of those voters who watched or were familiar with the debate believed Trump won, compared to just 23% who said Biden triumphed. What do you say, Gary?
Well, first of all, I say 51,000,001, because I was also watching it and I watched the whole debate. I thought that President Biden actually performed better than I expected him to, better than we had seen him in a lot of the events. And if we just cast our mind back to only a few weeks ago, there was much talk about how there were deep fakes of him undermining the confidence vote, undermining the ability to govern or to speak or any of that. And I thought he went up against Trump, a formidable debater, and much more forth. And I wondered also about the microphone levels, because, of course, Biden's voice was softer and Trump's was of course, all-encompassing. So that gave him an advantage in that regard. But, in fact, from my perspective, it meant that President Biden could go up against President Trump.
Yep.
So how do you rate a win or a lose? And I think the biggest indicator of that was the Democratic Party itself, which after the debate, quite amazingly, in my view, tore President Biden to shreds. Virtually the same people that were saying that he was very competent and agile and in charge. So a big question I have is, why have the debate 4 months before the election? Officially, we haven't even chosen the candidates for the election as yet. What was the rush that Biden had to come and fight with Trump now?
Yeah.
Could it possibly be that it might be time enough to remove President Biden as the candidate and still win the election as part of the strategy? And I just put that out there to contemplate.
Well, to me, the whole program was stilted. I only saw highlights of it. They had the wrong moderator. They should have had a Wolf Blitzer or somebody else and a person to fact check Donald Trump. That should have happened along the way too, but I found it stilted with one of the moderators there, the man in the three-piece suit.
Yes, and I also think that the most indicative part of this debate, which really hasn't been covered in the commentary, I don't think in the same way as we would do it, well, Trump didn't answer fundamental questions, such as, for example, his stance on climate change. So it's all very well. He got up there and he was talking on a previous topic, of course, so he didn't, you know, maybe even purposefully didn't have enough time to discuss this one. But, you know, he said, well, we have the cleanest water. Well, anyone that knows the science of climate change realizes that when you have global warming, you're really dealing with greenhouse gases. This is a specific issue that we have to deal with, and he's been on the record as saying, you know, when his new administration will drill, drill, drill. And so that's really something that that anybody should be concerned about. I also noticed they discussed the war, how he would end the war, not only in Ukraine, but also in Gaza. And in fact, looks like he would say that Israel would have a freer hand in his administration. So these are all fairly, these are points to consider when casting your vote for the future.
Yep, I totally agree that it didn't help that Biden went out to Cape, it's Camp David, the retreat, to work out a strategy with his advisors. I think they overdid it, and of course,
yeah, how do you know it didn't help?
I know
because he might have had a better performance this way.
Yeah.
And like I said, it worries me that it was kind of a setup for him, that that he was going to fail, and then Gavin Newsom would step in. But, you know, here are the problems with that. If you're really going to have this as a strategy for politics, then you want to paint the president as not being as competent or as clear-headed as he could be, he's got his finger on the nuclear button, for goodness sake.
He does.
If he's not in charge of a debate, how can he be in charge of the free world? How can the policies that are affecting the lives of millions of people, including the deaths of millions, we have current wars that could very easily get out of hand. So this is a terrible strategy, if that's the strategy, for approaching the problem of what candidate they're going to have. It could backfire terribly for the Democratic Party.
But, of course, because Biden was back on form, he was in front of an audience, a big audience, they were clearing and chat, and he was really on form the night after when he was back on the campaign trail.
Yes, but worrying when we have to say that. But yes, so that was, what was your impression of the debate, by the way?
As I said, it was a bit, I find these debates a bit stilted, and you got to have the right host. And I was thinking that maybe, I forget his name, but he's the grandson of Gloria Vanderbilt. He's of the Vanderbilt family. He's CNN 60 Minutes. You know the guy with the glasses.
Anderson Cooper.
He should have been there. I reckon he would have been the right host for that particular event. Anderson Cooper would have done a good job, I think.
Well, he might be there for the next one. But my impression was, we have major crises that are facing and can be existential for humanity. So we really needed a commentator that would hold people to account for that question.
Yep.
It's very important how we're going to deal with things that could end our future. And just to give a little scientific background to that, so we look at our planets, and we have three of them, and they're in what's called the Goldilocks zone.
Yes.
Around the sun. So we have a habitable, and we look now at other exoplanets. We look around because we've got these wonderful web and other telescopes that gives us all this wonderful information. And we have such a zone that life can flourish in this region. And we've got two out of the three planets without life, and only us. And so we did have life on Mars, very likely, and actually there's even a theory that we are the Martians, because life evolved on Mars, and it couldn't support life early on planet Earth because of tectonic and other forces, and that life came from asteroids and seeded us, so we're actually Martians, but that's another topic for another day. And we have Venus, where greenhouse gases, and it's our sister planet, greenhouse gases can melt lead, right? So that could be our future if we have an escalating runaway situation. So what we do about that is, important in a debate on the world stage.
Anyway, we've run out of time, but next week we may talk about the interview between the Australian ABC reporter and Marjorie Taylor Greene. Taylor Greene was cooked by that Australian reporter, and you saw the reaction of Marjorie Taylor Greene going off at ABC and all that, and throwing a microphone on the floor, etc. Did a hissy fit. You saw that interview, and we may talk about that next week.
I look forward to that very much.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
And not forgetting September the 10th, when we get a second opportunity to exercise our judgment as to who should be the next United States president, another and second presidential debate.
I wish I was American. I'd withstand. can't do that. It's 17 minutes to 2. Coming up, we'll talk about trains, telephones and Matariki. Afternoon, JD. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Have you got a train in the middle of your house?
No, maybe one day.
Your mother wouldn't be happy about that.
I don't think so.
Anyway, you want to talk about Matariki.
Yes, yes, I did talk on the radio previous Sunday about Matariki, and I went to the event on Friday. Oh, it was very good, and there's quite a few people, and the running of the trains went very well. I managed to get lots of photos and videos. And, yeah, a lot of happy people, a lot of people I recognised, and otherwise the staff kept it very well held together. So, yeah, that was a good experience. Looking forward to more trips in the future. I did hear a little bit they might be here in August, but we'll just see in the coming few weeks and months. But looking forward to more excursions and the next Matariki and any other events.
Must be difficult to budget on the support the public gives to the railway trips. The excursion trips go to interesting places. Not much evidence of your generation, typically. Why is that, Chidi?
So you're saying why there's so not many young people anymore. I feel like nowadays young people just don't find it as interesting anymore as it used to be. You see a lot of old photos of school kids in uniform going to the railway station and seeing trains, and it kind of just fell, and now they're more into different aspects like video games, and they just don't find it overall appealing to spend time anymore by railways. But by running excursions like GVR and other companies or organizations are doing, it helps influence younger people to get the kind of take up the hobby. And that's a big reason why I'm such a fan as well, is because they've put on such a display of vintage movements that it's just really caught my eye. And
You are on the verge of becoming a teenager, or what they call them, winks. Have you heard that term? You're becoming a wink. That's when the teenager, you become a teenager. Is there any other young people online that love trains as you do?
There's quite a few people around and about who are just older than me, you know, who like trains, and they chase trains, and sometimes I meet up with them, and it's a good community. Everyone is in the railways.
You keep your ear to the ground and learn from often the people involved in running our railways now. What is expected in the future? And you will have formed your own opinions about that. Now let's take your age, 12.
Yes.
And reverse those digits, and we have the magic number of 21. When you're 21, Jody, what advances, changes would you hope or expect there to be in the railways transportation of people and freight around our country?
Well, by the time I'm 21, lots will have changed. We will have different railway connections. Of course, CityLink will well be opened by then. Other railway lines will be open, and hopefully by the time I'm 21, there will be much more technological advances to railway safety and every aspect of the company. I believe that moving on, freight handling in the railway aspect will be a very different company, a different workplace. So hopefully for the better, and I'd like to see those changes happen when I'm in the job. But
I think by the time you may reach 21, trains will be driverless.
You reckon? Well, yeah, maybe overseas, but for now I find that hard to see driverless trains in New Zealand, or
it would cheat you of your childhood aspirations, wouldn't it?
Studying hard to become a train driver just to find out, oh yeah, the robots are driving. Oh, that'll be that'd be interesting.
It is interesting because this technology came out. Thank you, Jody, for coming in this afternoon on a cold day. This technology came out in fiction, the likes of the Jetsons and Star Trek. What do you think about that, all this new technology?
My personal opinion on all this new technology coming through, I don't know. I just feel like it's just strange to accept that now we have talking AI and everything, and then it's taking over jobs. Hopefully it doesn't happen. Honestly, I don't think replacing people with minds and making them into metal machines who, it's just doesn't sit well, really.
Yeah.
You know, taking on things that was done by humans and doing it by robots. It's just really strange overall, and hopefully robots don't take over.
Come back and see us next week, then we'll have more information on how's the cleaning of the telephones going.
Oh, it's going pretty well, yeah. I've done a little bit of restoring, fixing up. I've put some new metal parts in one of them, and hopefully I'm going to add some paint to one, but that's what's happening with the telephones.
I hope you're not going to put them in the system.
One day. I might wire them up one day. We'll see.
Oh, on that question of machines and their appeal, we can't trust entirely in the machinery because inexplicable things have happened, it seems, to the Cook Strait ferry that ran aground.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting thing that's happened. Yeah, that's just really, really strange.
Yeah.
I have yet to read full news articles that have been released, but maybe next Sunday I'll come back with a little bit more information.
We'll probably see you next week. We're talking about technology. And Hanna-Barbera made a series called The Jetsons, which had flying cars, had robots in the house doing the housework.
Meet George Jetson. His boy Elroy. Daughter Judy. Jane, his wife.
Yes, the Jetsons, Hanna-Barbera, and we're actually celebrating one of those guys' birthdays in to come. Good afternoon, Dwayne Porter.
Yeah, good afternoon, Trips.
Did Hal Tapu win yesterday?
Yeah, they clutch win against Hamilton Old Boys.
By how much?
32-24.
Were you there at the park, were you?
No, I was in Cambridge.
What were you doing in my hometown?
No, I wasn't in your hometown.
Anyway...
Hal Tapu 32, Old Boys 24, Vasily 45 over Otrahonga 5. You see, Te Aumiru had a close win against Melbourne, by 4 points, 39-35. Fraser Tech came at Morrisville Sports by 38-17, and it's a bye for Manabana and Hamilton Maris. So, the top of the ladder, there's the four top teams going to be in the top of the ladder, and I can tell you that it's a competition for this round and the next round. So hopefully we will see that the All Blacks will have a good win against the England box.
When is that game?
That's next Saturday.
Oh, everybody be watching that. I won't be because I'll be probably next door in the studio recording. But, hey.
But it's in the afternoon.
Oh, it's in the afternoon. Well, I'm still busy. I haven't got Sky television. And
it's one of these things that, it's the competition, and the four top teams, as I said, was Hamilton Old Boys, Hal Tapu, Fraser Tech, and Hamilton Maris. So it's worthwhile for those to go in. The top six or top eight or top four will knock out the bottom top four.
Anyway, we'll talk again next week. We've been remembering today Tony Hatch. Yes, he wrote this one. Crossroads, coming up, Trevor. Yes, That is the theme from Crossroads. That is Tony Hatch's composition. I thought it was the Abominable Snowman walking in here. He's all wrapped up for winter. Good afternoon, Trevor.
Good afternoon, yeah. I woke up this morning and I thought, how did I get into Siberia?
No. Got you. Have you parked your igloo outside your house?
Yeah, well, Dwayne said he'll let me out there because it's cold.
Yeah.
Before opening the door.
Anyway,
so I've said that I have to build an igloo.
Anyway, how many on the cycle lane this week?
I've seen four cyclists and none on the cycle lane, and none wearing helmets as per usual.
Okay, so. Trevor's talk. What's been in rattling your chains this week?
Well, I'm just thinking how lenient the laws are in this country in relation to motorists. For example, it's not a legal requirement to have your car insured, where just about every other country in the Western world, if you don't have a car insurance, it's an offence and you get fined for it. And another thing is that they're not drug tested, where most countries are. So a person could be high, but maybe sober alcohol-wise, and they're just as big a danger as somebody that's had too much to drink.
Fair enough, too.
Yeah, so...
Anyway, hey, anything else?
Oh, yes. Another thing is, that's my criticism on motorists and whatnot, but I must admit the fact that I'm here today is due to the courtesy of motorists on the road. Because when I go into my driveway, because of the pedestrian crossing they put up opposite the campus, there's always a backlog of traffic. I can never get out of my driveway unless a driver, out of courtesy, will wave me onto the road and let me in. And surprised how many motorists are of that nature. Yeah,
I get that feeling when I try and cross that that road outside the Hamilton City Council building. It's meant to be a shared space, but people don't think it's a shared space. They think they can travel through there without watching for pedestrians.
Oh, yeah, it's another situation.
Anyway, today we've been celebrating the music of Tony Hatch. He was born this day and he's 84 today. He wrote Crossroads. He wrote Downtown and other hits with Petula Clark. And we played it earlier. I'm going to play this again. This is dedicated to my mate Mel Driscoll, the two of us. The two of us will be back next week. Bye-bye for now.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.